They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, new episode, Crossover NBA Podcast, first week of the season edition. Lot to get into, lot of reactions, overreactions maybe to make. I've got a bold prediction in this podcast that might enrage Knicks fans even further. We'll get to all that with Howard Beck, the great writer over at Bleacher Report. He joins me in studio for a great conversation about what we've both seen from the first week of a really interesting NBA season. A quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, Howard Beck is here, senior writer, Bleacher Report, also the owner of one of the most accurate Bitmojis you will ever see. It's kind of scary. Howard, what's up, man?
What's going on, Chris? Look, I'm a late adopter to the Bitmoji thing. I think actually these are on the new iOS. I think it's just called stickers. But yeah, it kind of looks like me if I still had my hairline from like 1995, which is why I really love the Bitmoji sticker thing when I'm texting with you, because I just I just feel like a younger, more energetic me, and it's hard to keep up with you, not to mention keep up with your hair.
Yes. Well, I do take great pride in my hair, as you and everybody that knows me knows, but you're very fond of replying with the sticker / Bitmoji, whatever it is. So like when I say like, hey, can you come in to do the podcast? It's like Bitmoji sticker thumbs up. Like that's embraced it.
I got to say, I probably send those to you more than in any other conversation with other people because I know it just like it freaks you out. You don't even like the regular old emojis of like just a thumbs up. What like those even put you off. So I'm like, I'm just going to keep pressing the envelope here and see if I can just send Mannix over the edge.
I need like a three-person text chain with you and Casey Johnson, with both of you sending me stickers and Bitmojis. Like that might get me to just completely log off entirely.
That can be arranged, my friend.
We'll work on that for next time. Glad you could be here, though, Howard. Lot to get to. You can catch Howard, of course, over at Bleacher Report. He's got a terrific podcast himself, The Full 48, which you can listen to wherever you download podcasts. Fun first week of the season, Howard. And a couple things I want to hit you with. First and foremost, we went into this season, at least I did anyway, thinking that this was like one of those parody years, like where you were going to have like six or seven teams that could reasonably say that they were championship contenders. And maybe that's still the case. And there are a lot of teams out there that still believe that's the case. But as I watched the first few games, I feel like the Clippers are now the first tier. Like if you're making a tier of or a couple of tiers there, you've got the Clippers at one and like Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Denver, Portland, I guess if you want to say the Lakers, everybody else kind of a tier below. That's sort of the way I look at the first, week or so of the season. It might be kind of a bit of an overreaction, but I'm watching the Clippers without Paul George do some really impressive things. Offensively, they can beat you in a number of different ways. Defensively, they're like on a string out there at times, and Paul George is only going to amplify both those sides of the floor. What do you think of that? Have the Clippers changed your mind at all about, just how competitive the NBA can be this year?
I think the Clippers have simply reiterated or vindicated all of the preseason hype, which is that most of us, or at least many of us, I think probably the Vegas odds would underline this, most of the preseason predictions, everybody's prognosticating, all leaned toward Clippers over Lakers and Clippers over the rest of the West, to be determined to see how great of a gap it might be because, hey, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard have never played together. We do still have to see how this all unfolds, how they integrate themselves with this team that won 48 games before they arrived. But on paper, it certainly looked to all of us like that was the best built team. You and I think you discussed that on this pod even over the summer. And so to me, what we've seen in week one of the season from the Clippers is, yeah, they're just as good or maybe even better than we thought they could be. And yeah, they're doing it all without Paul George. Now, does that change my mind about whether that means they're in a different tier than the other contenders? I mean, I'm not going to go that far based on 1 week of results, Chris. I just think that if nothing else, we now know definitively the Clippers are exactly as good as we thought they might be or as great as we thought they might be, and maybe even better once Paul George gets back. But it's still going to be about the head-to-head in the spring when they go against the Lakers or the Nuggets or the Jazz or the Rockets, whoever it may be. And so when I'm thinking about like the tiers of the NBA, I'm still kind of thinking about it's that group of seven. It's the two in the East, Philly, Milwaukee, and it's the five in the West, Lakers, Clippers, Nuggets, Jazz, Rockets. Like, that's the group to me, and I think that that's going to be unchanged until somebody either really separates themselves from the pack or somebody just, you know, takes a serious tumble in the weeks to come. And I don't expect either of those things to happen. I don't know about you, but I feel like these teams are, you know, they're all about what we believe them to be. And that's even with Utah obviously getting off to a bit of a slow start, and you know, or not Utah getting off to a slow start, Mike Conley a bit of a slow start. You can find your little blemishes here and there with all these teams. It's that early. But I think it's still that group.
I like the in politics you have the gang of eight. In NBA, according to Beck, you got the group of seven. I like
there,
that.
There
I, and I buy it too. I mean, there's I see those teams as being the most legitimate contenders. I just look at the Clippers, man, and like I gave my, you know, preseason sixth man of the year vote to Terrence Ross with Orlando, and I already want it back. Like, can we just like give it? Lou Williams deserves the sixth man award. He's like Jamal Crawford.
Yeah.
Like, until further notice, Lou Williams is the best sixth man in basketball.
Someday we'll just rename the award the Jamal Crawford Lou Williams Award.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, like, you might as well like give them both, you know, like the Bill Russell Trophy. You get the Jamal Crawford Lou Williams Award. Like, I just don't know what they're going to wind up doing poorly. And I think when you get to mid-February, you're going to see some kind of big man bought out wind up in L.A. Like, I could see Aaron Baines winding up in Los Angeles. Mm. Like, if he gets bought out down in Phoenix at some point, I could see Baines playing for the Clippers. And man, that would be a huge addition because of his defensive ability. So I'm with you that it's still early to, I guess, separate everybody. But, man, they're really good in L.A. Now the Eastern Conference is very much a two-team race. But I got to tell you, my love affair with Pascal Siakam is strong right now. It's strong.
You are huge on that bandwagon.
I tweeted something out earlier. Like, he is, he to me is like a dark horse candidate for MVP. I really think that because he's going to be on a team that is going to win, you know, between 45 and 50 games, maybe even close to 50 on that end. He's going to be the face of that team. Like, Kyle Lowry's good, Van Vliet's good. But Pascal Siakam to me is just, you know, he's one most improved player last year. He could win it again this year. And he could be in the top five for MVP because his three-point shooting is better. His defense is still elite. He's one of those guys that you hate to make, like, the Kawhi Leonard comparison, but they're very similar. Like, they were both kind of under-the-radar guys coming out of college, and here they are in the pros, you know, within the first few years, really developing by working on their game. I mean, what are your thoughts on Siakam? Like, am I completely overstating the ceiling for this guy?
No, you're not overstating the ceiling at all, I don't think. I mean, I think that he clearly, like, the ceiling for him, is the ceiling the roof? Is it beyond the roof? I don't know. I've got to consult with Michael Jordan on that. His ceiling is as high as can be. And he has MVP potential. And his numbers right now bear it out, to your point: 27.5 points, 10 rebounds a game, 3.5 assists. So he's even kind of, you know, bumping that one up. He's been fantastic. And yes, he can defend just about anybody all over the court. And the Raptors, as a lot of us thought, are going to be really, really good with an asterisk, pending whether or not Masai Ujiri decides at some point to start spinning off pieces because he has to start thinking about what the next phase is. Now, he can keep this group as long as he wants to, of course. And they extended Lowry. Now, did they extend Lowry for the purpose of making it a better trade piece or for meaning that they wanted to extend this era a little longer? And Lowry you know, despite, you know, obviously Kawhi's the one who led them to the championship, but Kyle Lowry's the face of this era of Raptor basketball. And, you know, even as Siakam emerges, Lowry's a really important, fundamental, just identity icon for this franchise. But there's going to be a temptation in February, no matter where they are in the standings. If the contenders come calling and they need Kyle Lowry or Marc Gasol or Serge Ibaka, and those two guys are on expirings, is this going to be the same team? So when I think about talking about Siakam as an MVP candidate, yeah, for sure. The numbers, I think, Chris, you're right, are going to be there. And he's going to be dominant at both ends. And the Raptors are going to be really good. And I think they're probably top four, top five in the East. But what if Masai Ujiri starts taking calls and gets an offer he can't refuse on some key other rotation pieces, and if that drops them in the standings, which is possible, then that usually undermines your MVP case a little bit, because we usually still count wins and standings spot at the end of the season. So that's the only way I'd say it could that he might fall short of that. But man, even if that's the case, he'll end up on ballots.
Yeah, and look, Russell Westbrook was, I agree with you, Russell Westbrook was the outlier with
by
the
far.
MVP a few years back. You know, he was on a bottom half of the playoff conference Thunder team, but his numbers were so ridiculous. That was the first triple-double year that voters gave it to him. So you do have to be on, like, I think at least a top three team to be strongly considered for MVP, but I'm not sure what the motivation for breaking up this team this year is going to be for Masai. Like, unless some teams out there are like, all right, here you go. Here's a first-round pick in exchange for Marc Gasol. Like, if you get that, absolutely, you do it. Or here's a first-round pick in exchange for Serge Ibaka. Of course you do something like that. But unless you're getting real value back in return, I don't think there's a downside to playing this out and, you know, getting Siakam playoff experience again at a high level, this time as an alpha, getting Van Vliet playoff experience as an alpha, and maybe trying to use that cap flexibility next summer to either bring back some of the guys that are hitting free agency or you know, bring in new guys that can, you know, better complement Siakam and Van Vliet and the guys that are part of your core moving forward. I do think Lowry's interesting. I don't know if Lowry and Van Vliet are a long-term fit, or at least as long as Lowry's playing alongside each other. And I think there's going to be a market for Lowry in the next few months. I mean, I look at Minnesota as a team that could use a Kyle Lowry. They could use a Chris Paul. They could use a D'Angelo Russell if they went back, you know, to that well and tried to trade for him later in the season. But Minnesota, to me, is one of those teams that might be a point guard away from not being a contender, really, but from being like a conference finals, conference semifinals type of contender, because Karl Anthony Towns is a monster. Wiggins has been better, but we'll see what happens with the three-point shot and the mid-range game and all that stuff that plagued him last season. But you put a Lowry on a Timberwolves team, and I think that'd be pretty interesting. I think there are a lot of point guards you put on that team that would make that team even more interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the market for Lowry is going to be pretty vibrant. The guy's still really, really good, and he's got all that postseason experience, and he's a champion. And you're right, Minnesota's one spot that would make a lot of sense. I could see him in Orlando. And again, like, this is just speculating, right? I'm not saying that Orlando's preparing an offer or anything like that. I don't know I haven't even played with the trade machine to see what configurations could be. But the Magic is a team that really needs to take the next step and really does not have that frontline caliber starting point guard.
Fultz, come on, get on board, Fultz.
I'm hopeful for Fultz. I really, all the goodwill in the world toward his comeback. But until that happens, Orlando's another place. The weird one is this. I don't know how they make it happen. I think Kyle Lowry would be phenomenal with the Milwaukee Bucks. And, you know, the Bucks and Sixers, I mean, you can flip coins all day and spin yourself into circles about who's got the edge in what we expect will be the eventual Eastern Conference Finals, Bucks and Sixers. I think Lowry would be fantastic there. I don't know if there's a deal to be made to get him there. And the funny part of this is, too, I think the Toronto Raptors are absolutely positioning themselves, as a lot of teams are, to make a run at Giannis in 2021. And so the idea of helping the Bucks potentially, you know, win the championship or at least get to the finals by sending Lowry there, then turning around and trying to steal Giannis, I don't know. That I like all the little interwoven subplots there in my own head. But I do think that the Bucks, whatever Giannis said or didn't say to, was it the Harvard professor?
Yeah.
Whatever he did or didn't say, I do think it's true. Even if he didn't verbalize it or if he didn't say it in those words, I do think fundamentally it's probably true that Giannis needs to see them at a championship level. And, you know, the Bucks decided not to pay the tax, and they decided to let Brogdon go, and we'll see how that works out. And they might be fine this year, and they might be in the finals. But if the opportunity came along to get a multiple-time All-Star, a guy of Kyle Lowry's abilities, I think he'd fit great there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm with you on what Lowry would look like in Milwaukee. I don't think the Bucks have anything that they could offer that would make Toronto all that interested. There's not some blue chip young guys on the roster that would be interesting to Toronto. You're not going to give up one of your core players. And, you know, if you're Toronto, you don't want Eric Bledsoe. That's for sure.
No.
And, you know, you're not taking like a George Hill type either. Philadelphia, you know, it's interesting you bring up the Sixers. Like, would the Sixers, to get their hands on a Kyle Lowry, would they flip like a Tybal in a deal like that? I mean, Tybal looks like he can play, especially defensively. He's kind of got that sort of Marcus Smart to in him, you know, that defensive-minded menace that is a real ball hawk out there on the floor. But I'm not sure they make a deal like that, especially with Simmons working out as a point guard. And when they play so big, they're just so good defensively. Not that Lowry would hurt them defensively because he's still very good, but I think what's gonna decide what Philadelphia is this season is just how strong they are defensively. They can get away with some ugly offensive nights if they're just locking teams down, holding them to sub 40% from the floor, sub 30% from three, like 85 points overall. I mean, I think they're going to be well-positioned because of that defense, and that rotation is a big part of it. So I don't know. I think you have to look out west to a team like Minnesota and maybe some others for a real Kyle Lowry possibility. But you did mention Fultz, and I don't know, man. Like, I like what I'm seeing out of him early on in Orlando. I really do. I mean, he's giving you double figures every single night. He's playing with like more confidence than I saw him play at any point in Philadelphia. And he's even knocking down a couple of threes. He attempted, what, six threes in that game against Atlanta. So he's got some confidence now in him shooting that. And if he's mentally right, I think you and I would both agree that's like half the battle with him. So if he can get that mental part of it and get his game to catch up, I still think there's the ability for Fultz to live up to his potential. He's playing on a team that has no pressure on. Like, they're a playoff team probably in Orlando, but nobody expects the Magic to do anything. So you got that going for you. And you've got Steve Clifford, who's a great developmental guy. That to me is one of the bigger surprises this season is watching Markelle Fultz and the confidence with which he's playing.
Agreed. And it's a pleasant surprise. And look, on the one hand, it's very rare, I think, Chris, for a guy to come in, high lottery pick, great expectations, wash out for two straight years with his first team, go somewhere else, and then suddenly blossom in a major way, right? Like, guys might, you know, a Kwame Brown might eventually find his footing and be a competent and even a plus NBA player, but Kwame Brown, you know, I always say this, if Kwame Brown had been the 20th overall pick instead of number one, we'd view his career completely differently. He had a very solid, fine NBA career.
Right.
And contributed to some winning teams. But he was drafted number one, so he's viewed as a bust. It's not his fault. He was drafted number one. So we have to be fair to these guys. It's, you know, they don't pick where they're drafted. Fultz has the chance to be that rare case where he just looks like a complete bust after a couple of years and then has a whole new chapter emerge. And I thought the moment that trade happened, and I knew, like, I'm not the only one who knew, but it was obvious that he was not, his future was not going to be in Philly once it got past a certain point. But when it was Orlando that came calling and made the deal, I thought, this is perfect. Small market, not a lot of media pressure, not a lot of notice, period. Unless the Magic are great, no one's paying attention. Sorry, Orlando. That's a place where you can go and quietly get your head and your game together, rehab your career, and become the player that you still hope to be. Like, I'm not putting any ceiling on Markelle Fultz based on the last couple of years. I think it's altogether possible this kid gets it all together, whether it's mentally, physically, or otherwise, and we're starting to see a little bit of that. And yes, it helps to not have the pressure of being on a Philly team that, one, is in a fairly sizable market with a lot of media, and two, it's not the team that drafted you anymore. That's a huge difference. You don't have to be any – the Orlando Magic and their fans are not expecting you to be a franchise face or the guy who's going to get you to the finals. They just need you to be a decent young player who develops under their watch, and that's it. There's no pressure.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect situation for him, as you kind of laid out there, and I'm with you on the no pressure part, because I mean, what do they give up, like a protected first round pick to get Markelle Fultz? Like, and that's not a major investment in a player that has enormous upside. And every time I watched him, and I saw parts of a couple of games this year, but every time I'm watching him, I'm seeing shades of what I was watching when he was playing in Washington. You know, the shiftiness with the ball, which kind of reminded me a lot of like a Chris Paul type of player. And then some of the explosiveness. Like, he has been just, he had one dunk in one of those games that was just a violent attack on the rim. Like, he was just going for it there. And if they can just, you know, just keep working him and moving him forward, that still is a number one pick level talent. I mean, before, you know, things kind of derailed, we forget a little bit that he was like a consensus number one. Yeah. You know, Boston was ready to take him, you know, before everything kind of, you know, went in a different direction. They made that deal with Philadelphia. So, like, there still is enormous talent. I think you just can't, you know, stay the course with him, keep developing him with Aaron Gordon and some of those other young guys, and I think you've got a good young team to kind of build around moving forward. Another young team I want to hit on real quick, and a surprise team, Dallas. What's going on with Dallas right now? The Mavericks are 3-1, and they're like one of those league pass teams now. Like, you got Luka Doncic, who is just awesome. You got Porzingis, who is, you know, still Kristaps Porzingis, albeit, you know, one clearly starting to get his legs under him after missing all of last season. You've got some good other young pieces around them. Like, are we ready to start talking about the Mavericks as a potential playoff team in the West?
Yes. Absolutely. And this is not just overreaction theater on my part. The 3-1 start helps, but this is a team, Chris, that when push came to shove and I was playing around with preseason predictions and I was not sold on the Warriors as a playoff team. I'm still a little iffy on the Spurs, even though we know the golden rule, never, ever, ever, ever count out the Spurs. I was ready to put Dallas in the playoff bracket, and when I finally jotted down my eight teams, I did put them in there. So, pleasant surprise in some regard, because I thought it might take them a while to get to this level, but overall, I'm not surprised. You know, the interesting thing with them is this. On paper, you would look at it and say, man, Luka and Porzingis should be fantastic, but the two buts were, I'm really not sure about this supporting cast, and we don't know if Kristaps Porzingis is still the same guy who made the All-Star team a couple years back, because we hadn't seen him in a year and a half since the ACL. And he's a big, kind of gawky guy at 7'3", who plays it on the perimeter and, you know, moves kind of funky. And you wonder, does a guy that size supposed to move that way? And, is the knee going to hold up? And how's he going to look? He looks phenomenal. And it's early. And, you know, we're all going to knock on wood, as the Mavericks will for the next several years with that max contract they signed him to. But, damn, the dude looks dominant. And both those guys are averaging 20-plus points. Their composite box score right now is 47 points a game, 16 rebounds, 10 assists. So the two of them together have been fantastic. It's kind of an unguardable pick-and-roll combo. And the supporting cast that I was, you know, just kind of question, I'm not sure, so far has been great. They have, outside of Luka and Porzingis, they have six other guys who are averaging at least 8 points a game, between 8 and 11 points a game. So they don't have anybody else who's going to drop 20, 25 on a given night, most likely. But they got a bunch of guys who are just really competent. And, you know, Dillon Wright and Seth Curry, Jalen Brunson, the occasional Tim Hardaway Jr. game. It's still, you know, you have to squint a little bit to see the supporting cast. But look, Rick Carlisle's always gotten the best out of guys. So that matters a lot, too. So, and if you have two dominant pieces, Chris, as you know, everybody else just looks that much better, because nobody has to play above themselves or try to do something that they're not built to do. You just let the two stars go to work, and you find the gaps to perform yourself. You do what you do best, and they've got some shooters and playmakers around them. And, yeah, I mean, this is not a mirage. I don't think that the Mavs start as a mirage. No, obviously they're not going to win 75% of their games. But in terms of them being looking like a playoff team, that part is not at all a mirage.
They're a fun team to watch, and Luka's a big part of that. And Porzingis coming back, of course, is huge for them. I like that Porzingis has come back as like this 3-point sniper. Like, he's attempting like 7.5 threes
maybe
per game. That's way up from his career highs in New York. Luka's at like 8.5 threes per game. So they're giving you like 16 threes every single time out. That's an incredibly dynamic pick and roll combination, because if you can just pop out from beyond the three-point line or go to the basket as a 7-foot whatever Porzingis is right now, I mean, that's just... they're just dangerous. I'm with you on the supporting cast. Like, can Dellen Wright continue to be this consistent? Can, you know, they're playing like Maxi Kleber, and they got a lot of guys there that you wonder if they're going to hold up over 82 games. But they've got a cornerstone now. They've got two guys that are just, they're just dynamic, and you're going to be able to build around them. And I think when free agency comes around, you're going to have guys want to play with them. Like, they're just unselfish, good players who are only going to get better. You're going to be able to attract free agents, I think, to play with Porzingis and with Luka Doncic. The other part of this, the equation is, of course, like, what is New York thinking right now as they watch Porzingis do this? I know Knicks fans out there listen to the podcast and always get angry at me in social media. Like, they'll continue to insist that Porzingis was never going to come back, to which I'll always counter that there has not been a player in NBA history that turned down a max level contract extension on their rookie deal. They just don't do it, because the simple fact is you can't get that money back. Other contracts, you can conceivably get the money back down the line. You're either taking like the $4 million qualifying offer, or you're taking, what is it, $18 million in that first year. That's why guys don't turn it down. But the Knicks got to be looking at this and be like, man, we have this guy. I know we rolled the dice and thought Durant and Kyrie were coming there, but, you know, Porzingis is already looking like he's continuing on that upward track of being a franchise player.
If Porzingis stays healthy and keeps playing the way he's playing, Chris, one, it's just going to be season-long, not just season-long, years-long torture of Knicks fans, because they waited years to get a young guy who could be a franchise star and lead them for a decade. And he is by far the best player that they've drafted in whatever, however long it had been since Patrick Ewing. 30 years, whatever it's been. It's a long, long time. And they finally got that guy, and they squandered it. And you can say, yes, he wanted out, but you don't have to grant the request. You can play it out. You can match. He was going to be restricted. You can match. He's not taking the qualifying offer and walking. Nobody's doing that. You've just pointed that out. It just doesn't happen. And they had the upper hand. They had the control, and they could have re-signed him and then still traded him later if he was still unhappy. And by the way, that unhappiness is on them too. You can't wave it all away and say, well, we had no choice and he wanted out. That's not the way this works. You're an NBA franchise. You have to value the assets that you acquire. You have to understand how to work with your players to make them happy there. And if they're not, yes, eventually maybe you have to move them. But I said it at the time, I've said it every day since, it was not the wisest use of this pot of gold you have in your hands. There's so many different ways you could have played that out, including if you traded him at the trade deadline. Let's say that was the only way out of this, and I don't think it was. But if you had to, you didn't have to use him as bait to pawn off bad contracts. You could have traded him for his actual value, which would have been multiple young players and picks. Instead, you get three players, two of whom are already gone in Wes Matthews and DeAndre Jordan, a third Dennis Smith Jr. who, you know, bad timing to be picking on Dennis Smith Jr., and my condolences to him and his family. But as a player, there was already a consensus around the league that he was not going to be what he had been hyped up to be. And there are people around the league who don't even think he's a rotation guard, much less a starting guard or an upper tier guard. So you got nothing out of the players that you acquired, probably. And then you've got the two picks, which, again, as I said at the time, if the Mavericks are as good as we think they could be with Porzingis and Luka together, those two first-round picks are not going to be very good. That's not the best return that you could have gotten for Kristaps Porzingis, and that's what they're going to have to face. And normally, I'm the one who always pumps the brakes and says, you got to wait a couple years to see how these trades play out before you really judge them. And it's even with Luka and Trey. I mean, yes, the Mavericks have the upper hand in that one right now, but we should still wait and see how things work for Atlanta with Trey Young and everything else that they got in return. But in the case of the Knicks, the referendum on that deal began yesterday, and it's not looking good for the Knicks, and that's how that front office is going to be judged. And we'll see how the rest of this season unfolds. But you didn't get the stars you wanted with all that cap room, and that was, if that was the purpose of the trade, then you already lost on that trade. And if the purpose was to get back valuable pieces, well, you didn't get much value back. So, yeah, they're in the hole right now, and I don't know what it's going to take for them to be able to justify that trade long term, unless the Mavericks go into the tank in the next couple of years and those picks become something really valuable.
Going back to the Porzingis deal, not to continue to rehash all this, but they pulled the trigger on that awfully quickly. You know, and they, you and I both know they didn't exactly canvass the league looking for the best offer. And if you're going to trade a player of that type of caliber, you've got to make sure you maximize that value. You've got to do what any competent team would do, and that's inquire with all 30 teams about what kind of offer you'd put together. And maybe ultimately you take the Dallas offer. Maybe teams out there were a little wary of Porzingis and didn't know if they wanted to pay him and all that stuff. But at the very least, you got to call everybody. And you and I both know they didn't do that when it came to Porzingis. But, you know, with the Knicks, are we on David Fizdale watch? Like, are we there yet? I would have thought, Howard, if they lost the Bulls, we would be. Like, if they had lost the second straight home game after absolutely quitting in the home opener. I watched that Celtics game. I was part of the studio broadcast for that one in Boston. They quit in the second half, like, in your home opener. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, like, are we really thinking about, you know, a David Fizdale replacement? I don't know who they would replace him with on that bench, because nobody really jumps out at you.
No.
But, you know, that's a 17-win team last season. I know that that's not all Fizz's fault, certainly, because they were designed to play that way and they wanted to tank. But, you know, to start the season like this, if they had lost that Bulls game, man, I would have thought that we could be on, you know, Fizdale watch before the end of the month.
Yeah, I do think that they dodged a major bullet in beating the Bulls. They were down early in that game. It's like 16.
Like 18 in the first quarter.
And by the way, really fascinating. So I left at halftime, as I sometimes do. But I was there for the first half when they fell down so early. And there was no booing. There was no, like, it was a really weird crowd that night. And I thought, man, what is up with Knicks fans? Like, last year, I get it. They let go of the rope, and Knicks fans were just like, they were like, fine, we're going to get Zion. We don't care. We're getting Zion and Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and, you know, the ghost of Michael Jordan. Like, they didn't care last year. So they stopped. There was no booing. There was no reactions. They were just fine with it. They were zen about the whole thing. But they're supposed to be better now. And to be getting their butts kicked by double digits in the first quarter of a game against the Bulls at home and no reaction from the crowd was very strange. And to their credit, the Knicks came back and won. Bobby Portis, big revenge game. That's fine. That's nice. I still think if we're talking about coaches to keep an eye on this year, I think Fizdale is certainly on that list. It's unfair because this is only year two for him, and year one became a pseudo teardown, you know, tanking year. But listen, we know how this works, Chris. If you're losing, and if ownership is getting grumpy about it, and if the fans do start booing and are upset about it, all exacerbated by watching the Mavericks become a playoff team before their eyes, front office isn't firing itself. If you need somebody to sacrifice at the altar, it's the coach. And Fizdale's, again, it's only year two. But this is the Knicks. A lot of guys don't make it to year three with the Knicks. You know? Ask Mike Woodson. Ask Jeff Hornacek. Ask Isaiah Thomas. Larry Brown. Lenny Wilkins. I mean, it's you know, it can turn on you in a hurry. And I also think that, look, I'm not going to build a case to fire Fizdale. So let me make this clear. But if you want to start picking apart what he's doing or has done or hasn't done, he had a three-way competition for point guard in the preseason between Elfrid Payton, Frank Ntilikina, Knicks patron saint, and Frank Ntilikina, and Dennis Smith Jr. Now, Dennis Smith Jr. got hurt, so that put a crimp in the whole thing. But that was the three-way battle, and then on opening night, he started Alonzo Trier and decided to put the ball in the hands of his rookie, RJ Barrett. Curious, to say the least. And then he's changed it up since then. And now they've got guys banged up. But, you know, where's the conviction? Where is this is my guy and I'm riding with him? Ntilikina continues to be this, you know, completely undervalued, end of the bench, gets in for 30 seconds here or there. And then the next thing you know, you got to dust him off and he comes out, locks somebody up, and everybody says, oh, he's actually got some value. And then he just disappears again. So, like, where's the consistency? And in his defense, the front office hasn't helped him in that regard because they've given him a lot of overlapping pieces. And in the case of point guard, there really is no one obvious choice there. But come on, invest in a guy. Pick your guy and say, this is the young guy we're going to grow with, you know, and stick to that. And that front court rotation and all these forwards that are blocking some of your youth or at least getting in the way of, you got to sort it out. Pick, you know, name your rotation and stick with it and ride with it. And it just feels like there's a lot of, you know, just kind of veering here and there, feeling your way.
Yeah, I think, look, if you're the Knicks, to me, your rotation has to be Mitchell Robinson, RJ Barrett, Kevin Knox, and, you know, Neil Akina and or Dennis Smith. Like, just play those guys. And if they can play, great. Like, it's a big win. If they don't, I don't know that it's going to cost you more than it would cost you to play them. I don't think you're going to win more games if you're, you know, extending Julius Randle's minutes or playing Marcus Morris or, you know, giving Bobby Portis more time. Like, tell those guys they're backups. Like, this is a young team right now, and you've got to see if these guys can kind of find some chemistry together. I like what I've seen in Barrett. I'll say that.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh no, he's been great.
I didn't think he was a shooter, and maybe he's not ultimately, but he's made shots in the first few games of the season, and if he can give you like a consistent like mid to high 30s from 3-point range, everything else in his game is going to blend nicely into the NBA. That was my big concern, Howard, that RJ Barrett would just be this kind of like, I'm trying to find a comparison, but just somebody that just put his head down and went to the basket and tried to score that way. And that doesn't work at a high level in this league. When I'm watching him shoot with touch, like if he's able to do that, if that sort of like plays out over the course of a season, that's going to be good news for the Knicks. But you got to get him that playing time there.
No, and he looks really, really good. And I think that's the one thing that maybe is keeping Knicks fans from losing their minds is that it does look like this kid could be special. It's early, but early returns are very good. They are playing him a lot of minutes. In the modern NBA, that is a little bit of a curiosity in and of itself. He's averaging over 37 minutes a game, but he looks really good, strong, versatile, very confident. Does look like a guy maybe you can build around. I mean, is he going to be a multiple-time All-Star? I don't know. But he looks really good. And Kevin Knox is looking better than he did as a rookie. That's a low bar. But all you want to see at this point is progress, and Knox seems to be starting to find his way. So that's a plus. But this team has a long way to go, to say the least. And I do think that while you want young guys to earn their minutes, I don't know that it's been the best policy the last couple of years to keep bringing in veterans who then block the youth from learning by trial and trial by fire.
Today's episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast is brought to you by CBS Sports HQ, the brand new streaming sports news network. It is live 24/7 and costs you absolutely nothing. That's right. It's sports coverage that's always on and always free. Always. I check it out every morning. It has become a part of my daily routine. CBS Sports HQ is coverage always focused on the game. Tons of highlights, breaking news as it happens, fantasy advice, and something we care about deeply here, gambling picks and analysis to get that extra edge. I know that when I turn on CBS Sports HQ, I'll see the tips and trends I need to win all my bets. And don't forget, you can get access to all this great coverage completely free. I don't mean free for a week or for a month. If you have some special cable package, it's totally, completely free for everybody. You don't even need to log in. Just download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, or other connected device at any time to watch CBS Sports HQ. No fake debates. Just sports for real sports fans at the great price of completely free. You don't even have to log in or sign up for anything. Download CBS Sports app and watch CBS Sports HQ today. Can I give you a crazy prediction for the Knicks this year?
Oh, yeah. Fire away.
All right. My prediction that the end of the season, Mark Jackson's the head coach.
Who? By the end of the season?
End of the season.
Not Mark, next July.
No. And before the end of the season, Mark Jackson is a midseason hire.
Wow.
For the Knicks. Mark Jackson, and I'm sure you know some of this, like Scott Perry likes Mark Jackson. Like, and Mark Jackson was a legit candidate for the Knicks job before Fizdale got it. I think some people in the organization talked Scott Perry out of Mark Jackson. I think that's how it's somewhat played out. And if you know, and Fizdale, I think he's a excellent basketball guy, and if you talk to people in Miami, they swear by him, But he did only last a season plus in Memphis, and certainly there were reasons for that as well. You know, some conflict with players, Marc Gasol being the most notable. But if things go south, then he doesn't really have this great history of being able to kind of rally these guys and keep them together and all that. If the Knicks are looking to make a change, I could see them just turning around and offering Mark Jackson the job, and Jackson would take it. Like, I mean, he wants to get back into coaching. Like, there's no question about that. And the Knicks job, it's familiar for him because he's an ex-Knick, and you could maybe sell that, and you can go back and say, look, this guy won 50-plus games with Golden State, but it's long ago as that was. I could see that happening. If the Knicks don't turn this thing around, I think Mark Jackson finishes the year as the head coach.
Wow, there's a flaming hot take.
There you go. How's that for a take?
There's a bold prediction. No, it makes a lot of sense. And look, he'd be a popular choice. I mean, I think Knicks fans, they're really, from the moment that Fizdale was hired, Knicks fans fell in love with Fizdale. He's just got that engaging, charismatic personality. He's got that Miami pedigree, and I do think that there are still high hopes for him here in New York. I also know, having been here for the last 15 years, that every single time this job comes open, there is a very loud, passionate contingent of Knicks fans who would love to see Mark Jackson back at the Garden as the head coach. He'd be a very popular choice. He'd have that cachet on day one, and with players too, I think. And he certainly deserves another shot, whether it's here or somewhere else, whether it's now or in the future. And you know, he did build that Warriors team up to a certain point. I think Steve Kerr was the one who his offensive philosophy was what was needed to get them to where they ultimately ended up. But Mark Jackson built them from this team that had been losing forever into a top-tier defensive team and a 50-plus win team. He'd be fascinating. I mean, we're nowhere near this yet, Chris, obviously. But I do think as quickly as things can change here, as volatile, as impulsive as James Dolan is as an owner, nothing would surprise me.
I want credit if this goes the way I'm saying, Howard.
I mean, you've staked it out on your own pod. So, I mean, there's, you know, you have the tape available to you.
The tapes. I want a Bleacher Report story on this with me cited as the original source on all of it.
When it happens, I'll have you on my podcast, and you can just run victory laps for an hour.
I do like a good victory lap, that's for sure. All right, we got to talk about the Lakers before we go. LA, they're doing what they should have done to start the season. Like, this is where they need to be. You know, 3-1, only the loss to the Clippers is a blemish on their resume. I looked at their early schedule, and I said to myself and to others, like, you know, if they don't go like 8-2 or 7-3 to start the season and get into mid to late November looking at as a top-tier playoff team, there could be problems because this is the weakest part of their schedule. Like, they're in it right now, and they've done it to their credit. Like, they've played well. Anthony Davis is just a monster. LeBron has been playing well. They're still missing some pieces. Kyle Kuzma's now on his way back, I guess. I just saw he's assigned to the minor league affiliate there in L.A. to continue his rehab from that foot injury. What do you make of what you've seen early on from the Lakers? Have they been what you thought? Have they been better, worse? Where do you see them?
No, I think they've been very, very good, clearly. And it's what I think we pretty much expected. I mean, I think what's always going to be most fascinating was how quickly do LeBron and AD find their chemistry, which they're you know, LeBron's a freaking genius at the game, and he wants AD to thrive. So that wasn't that big of a question. But, you know, until you get on the court and start doing it, it's fair to wonder how it's going to go. It's been seamless. It's been perfect. I don't think anybody could ask for more from those two as a tandem. And they are, you know, I talked about Luka and Porzingis being unguardable. LeBron and AD are the most unguardable tandem in the league, like from day one. And that's what's going to make them potentially dominant. The question has been and will continue to be, is the supporting cast good enough? It's been good enough so far. Early returns, good, but, you know, it's early. They got to get Kuzma back, as you mentioned. That seems like it's on the horizon. Rondo, for whatever Rondo's got left. But it's still fair to wonder about the strength of their guard core. It's still fair to wonder whether they've got enough shooting around them. And it's still a curiosity how much time AD spends at center versus power forward and, you know, kind of forcing the issue with that JaVale McGee-Dwight Howard tandem, which, again, those two have been pretty good so far. I've been really fascinated by and will continue to be by how LeBron kind of steps back to put AD out front. And that, you know, it's what he said he would do. And it's probably the best thing for LeBron at this stage of his career, with his 35th birthday coming up in December, to let Anthony Davis carry as much load as possible. And so what we've seen so far, LeBron usage rate still up over 31. So LeBron's not exactly like dropping back and into the scenery there. But Anthony Davis is on pace for a career high in usage at 34.6. And I can't remember who had the stats, so sorry to whoever I'm not crediting properly here. But when they're on the court together, LeBron's usage is dropping to about 25, and Anthony Davis is still at the, like, 33. So when they're on the court together, LeBron is definitely deferring to Anthony Davis in a way that I don't think we ever really saw much of when he was with Dwayne Wade or with Kyrie Irving. And you know, this is as it should be at this stage of his career. And when LeBron needs to do his thing, he will, and he'll win them some games, no question. But it's going to help him be that much fresher in the spring to be able to just ride Anthony Davis for the rest of it. Now, Anthony Davis also has a shoulder injury, and we know his injury history. So, you know, he's got to be protected too. And that's where I start to get concerned about the strength of the cast with them.
Yeah, and I think they need Rondo back, like, I think to reduce that usage rate a little bit for LeBron and take some of that playmaking responsibility away from him, you need Rondo. As flawed as he is as a player, and especially with the shooting, he still is a really high IQ guy that having him out there, I think, would be a plus for them. I want to see what Kuzma looks like coming back and what position he plays. And I also want to see how does Frank Vogel ultimately deal with that center position? Because there's no doubt that the best version of the Lakers is an Anthony Davis, LeBron, Kuzma front court. And
yes,
as quirky as it is to see Dwight Howard out there pulling down rebounds and playing a role and talking about how this is kind of what he wants out of his career, and JaVale McGee is still a contributor, you're not going to win at a high level with those two guys on the floor. Like, they're good for spot duty here or there, but in today's NBA, you need Davis playing the five. I know he hates the five, but you got to have him out there playing the middle, because the floor just opens up when he's playing center. You don't get bogged down with, you know, a Dwight hanging out in the paint or JaVale hanging out in the paint. We know Anthony Davis can shoot the three, and all of a sudden, instead of having a shrunken floor, you got one all spaced out with Kuzma and LeBron and Davis, and, you know, even Danny Green, who's a great shooter, and you put Caldwell Pope out there on the floor and hope he can get going. Like, I think that's going to be
really key.
Like, can you convince Anthony Davis, and is Frank Vogel willing to play Davis like 75% of the game at the center position? Because I think ultimately that's what he has to play.
Yeah, and that'll probably be more the case in the postseason, Chris, I think, because that will be their best winning formula. But again, for the purposes of preservation, conservation, does it help to have JaVale or Dwight out there next to Anthony Davis, so that they're the ones banging with Jonas Valanciunas or Jokic or Embiid? Like, it's, you know, this is not the time of Patrick Ewing and Shaq and Hakeem Olajuwon, but there are still some big bodies out there that if Anthony Davis, who has got the injury history and has already got the shoulder thing going on now, if you want to protect him and not have to do that for, you know, his full allotment of minutes in a game, fine. But when it's winning time, when it's the fourth quarter, when it's the postseason, yes, their best lineup absolutely is going to be Anthony Davis, LeBron, and Kuzma across the front line with some combination of whoever in the backcourt. I'm going to say hopefully not for their sake, KCP. But, you know, they'll patch it together with the guards. Then it's you know, Danny Green and somebody. And yes, having Rondo back to take some of the load off LeBron in the meantime would be good. I still think that, you know, they could use a little bit of fortifying in that roster, but is that a roster that's good enough to make a run to the finals and win a championship because of the two at the top? Yeah, it is.
I want to see, like, the Lakers and Clippers fighting over those buyout guys and see which one, you know, these buyout guys decide to go to. And how big a difference it makes. There's got to be somebody out there. I mentioned Baines earlier, and
yeah,
maybe it's somebody else.
But Iguodala, like, Andre Iguodala is like hanging out. Like,
yeah,
I don't, like. By the way, I don't think Iguodala is going to be a buyout candidate. I think ultimately, when we get to December 15th, I think the Memphis Grizzlies are absolutely determined to make sure that they get value out of him. That they're not going to just buy him out, cut him loose. They're going to do everything possible to find a trade. And I know it's difficult, but I think that's the way that's going to go. That said, they're still going to be jockeying because the Lakers and Clippers, while neither of them have necessarily a surplus of pieces to move out anymore, they're both certainly going to be chasing him.
Yeah, that's a bit of an understatement, Howard, that they don't have a surplus of pieces to move. I don't think they have anything. Like, they could sell, like, Lawrence Frank's old Nets practice gear, like, to get something back.
They might have, like a couple cans of, like, Chef Boyardee ravioli sitting in a pantry somewhere. And
yeah, like, future rights to Kurt Rambis in some capacity. I don't know. It's just, it's the cupboard is bare for both those teams. That's why that buyout market is really interesting. Howard, always appreciate it, man. Check out Howard's stuff over at Bleacher Report. Listen to his podcast, The Full 48. He had a good one with Casey Johnson, one of my other... What's the plural of nemesis? Is it nemesises? Nemesi?
Nemesis? I think nemesis.
Nemesis?
Yeah.
Nemesis? I don't know. Whatever the plural of nemesis is, Casey Johnson is one of them. But Howard, man, always great to talk to you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. Been fun. Mm-hmm.